Okay, Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning service. Thanks so much for joining us for our scripture study today. Before I get started, I did want to say that I got an email this morning or a text from Ronnie Fulcher and just asked that people kind of keep something in prayer. He said he's got an unspoken request. I believe in prayer. I think most of you do as well. So just keep Ronnie in your prayers over a situation that is weighing on him at this time. Thank you very much. I wanted to also let it be known here on this particular Sabbath. I wasn't going to tell everyone, but I decided that I can't hold a secret very well. So I am writing a book. The book is in the process. Now, I've said this before, so some people are saying, yeah, sure you are. You said that in 2009, and you said that and so forth. Well, I am in the process, so I've gotten quite a bit done already. I feel very inspired about the topic. It has to do with the topic that I presented at Charlotte this year, and it's related to this idea of finding the hand of Moses. And so I hope that the rough draft of this work will be ready before I go to Israel June the 20th. Now, that's really pushing me because John sees me every day probably, and he knows that I'm kind of busy, but I'm busy on this. So that's the goal. My long-term goal, or a little bit more realistic, is to have it available by my birthday, September the 1st. See how I threw that in case people want to send me gifts and so forth. So, but anyway, so that's the goal. It's something I'm very excited about. I'm very excited to share this work. And it just so happens that part of the book that I'm working on ties in a little bit with today's class. So some of it is something that I didn't have to do additional to the book work. It ties in a little bit. Of course, I can't let everything out today because then you'd say, well, why would I even read the book, right? So I did want to say that that is underway. Now, we've got 2 weeks until, according to the Jewish calendar, we are at Shavuot. Now, as you know, traditionally, Shavuot or Pentecost, 50 days, that's where we get the idea of Pentecost, the Greek word Pentecost. Shavuot can mean sevens, weeks, it can mean oaths, several different meanings, but we are almost to Shavuot. Traditionally, Shavuot is a day, according to traditional Judaism, that is associated with Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. It is associated with that watershed event at Sinai or Horeb, where God lovingly gives his testimony, his commandments, his covenant to the assembled children of Israel at the base of the mountain. And so it is therefore appropriate that we discuss the topic that we are currently working through. Now, there is nothing in the entirety of human history, absolutely nothing, that compares to this event. I had the song Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares to You, going in my head while I said that. I'll spare you. But there really is nothing that compares to this 10 words called the testimony. I wanted to sort of recap and just to set all of us on the same page, a couple of passages so that we're all together and we understand exactly what I'm talking about. Go with me to the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 31, Exodus 31. And I'm going to build up to the material that I want to bring to you today. And by the way, I know that a lot of you took me seriously when I said I gave you some homework last week. And I know that Vicky Acker really took it seriously because she did some good work. So you ought to go back and look on our Facebook group. Not that you others didn't. I'm not saying Vicky's my favorite, but she really put some good stuff out on the Facebook group. So, but what we wanted to do was we wanted to look at everything. I introduced an idea called reading horizontally. I've talked about it before, but I kind of stressed it last week. And that is, you take a subject that occurs in various books of the Torah, and you put them side by side so that you can compare and contrast, and you can look for significant, distinct differences in what is presented in those documents. And so some of that work has been done for you. I'm just saying. Exodus 31, verse 18. It says, and he there is Jehovah, and he gave to Moses, when he had made an end of speaking to him upon Mount Sinai, two tablets of the testimony. Tablets of stone written with the finger of God. Tablets of stone written with the finger of God that were given to Moses from Jehovah. All right. Now, some will associate, they go, well, how literally do we take that? I take it pretty literally. There is a passage in the Exodus narrative where finger of God denotes the power of God. So you could say, well, I don't know if it's literally. I think maybe, you know, if you're imagining a finger like in a movie scene, but I kind of like that image, honestly. So, do with it what you will. But God's finger wrote in stone, Exodus 31, 18. Now go with me to Exodus 32 and verse 15. And Moses turned and went down from the mountain, and the two tablets of the testimony were in his hand. Tablets written on both their sides, on the one side and on the other, were they written in Hebrew, mizeu mizeh, from this and from this. It's like you can imagine the tablet is held up and it's describing, the writer goes, mizeu mizeh. You see that? It's a tablet, by the way. And the tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved upon the tablets. Now, go with me to the book of Deuteronomy, the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 4. Now, one of the things that I'm going to do today, and it's a little bit difficult in this teaching operation that I've got here where you're watching or listening to me and I'm trying to convey what I want to do, you're going to have to almost not watch me and look at the text because I'm not doing anything special. I'm not going to do any juggling acts or anything. So you can look at the text that I'm going through because I'm going to be going from Exodus to Deuteronomy to Exodus to Deuteronomy. Ideally, you would be looking at this on the screen side by side. But we're not doing that today for you, so you'll just have to hold a hand there. Now, look at Deuteronomy 4, and I want to read verses 12 and 13. And Jehovah spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the voice of the words, but saw no form. Only a voice. And he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, the 10 words, and he wrote them upon 2 tablets of stone. So this, remember last week when we talked about the first tablets, I said, you can read in Exodus that the tablets were the work of God. You can read in Exodus that it was the writing of God. You can read that it was done with the finger of God. You can read that it was the 2 tablets. But what you can't read in Exodus is what was on it. It's only in Deuteronomy that it says the 10 words. Okay? Now, what I'd like to do now is I want to do a short, brief recap so that we slide into today's material. And you're ready. We demonstrated last week that this testimony, the 10 words, the covenant that's written on the tablets of stone, which is a written record of that which was spoken from the mountain on the day of assembly, becomes the focus of everything. It's the most significant thing, object, that has ever been introduced into the world in which we live. Think about that. Nothing is like this. Have you ever heard of any other document that is the work of God written on tablets of stone by the finger of God? So this becomes the focus point. It's the most important object in all of the Bible, and it is everything points to it. In other words, this document, as you'll see, this divine document is then going to be placed into the box, the chest, the Aron, the Ark, and then that Ark becomes known as the Ark of the Testimony. In other words, the whole purpose of the, what's the box for? I mean, it can be beautiful. We'll talk about it today. We're going to talk about this Ark of the Covenant today because it's really cool stuff. I mean, it's this box, and it might be beautiful, and according to certain sources within the Torah, it says that it's made of acacia. It's coated on the inside and on the outside with gold. It's got a lid that's gold. It's got on the lid, there are these two cherubim who are facing one another with their faces towards the lid, their wings outstretched, touching one another in the center. They're golden coated, they're acacia wood poles that are put through rings by which it was carried. I mean, this is gorgeous. But really what matters is what's on the inside. And just for a little bit of a deeper level teaching, this is about as deep as I'll go, so are you. What's beautiful is what's on the inside. See, this is what it's really about. It's an inner beauty. Now, the box is gorgeous, but it's what's on the inside. So the chest becomes known as the chest of the covenant. There's a veil which is known as the veil of the ark, right? Or the veil of the testimony is the way it's put. And then, aside from that, you have the tent, which is called the tent of the testimony. And then you have the Mishkan, the tabernacle of the testimony. Notice that everything is described as whatever it is and how it relates to this thing, this object. Everything points to it, the chest of the veil of the tent of the tabernacle of. So last week we talked about the first set of tablets, which, by the way, never in the narrative make it into the box. They're never covered by the veil. They're never placed in the tent. They're never placed in the tabernacle. That first set doesn't make it. So everything that we covered last week is describing how all of this is produced for the purpose of being associated with the testimony, but the first set doesn't make it. So I've called today's class, The Tablets, Take Two. And we're going to try this again. God gives the commandments to Moses, and Moses comes down, and this is where we pick up today. So let me tell you, we have two accounts of what I'm going to cover today. We have the account that is in Shemot in the book of Exodus, and we have the account that is in the book of Devarim, in the book of Deuteronomy. Exodus is presented as a third-person account, right? And again, this is the subject of the book that I'm writing. So I'm beginning to introduce this more and more in my teaching because it is something that should be noted. We should pay very close attention. Of course, you should always pay close attention when you're reading the scriptures. But there is a distinct difference, and there are distinct differences between that which Exodus records and the manner in which it's recorded, and that which Deuteronomy records and the manner in which it's recorded. Deuteronomy is a first-person account. The best way to describe it is that if John and I are interviewed about something that I did. Now, John can be very accurate in his description, but my description of what I did, assuming that I'm telling the truth, will likely be more accurate. Or it's going to at least read differently, even if they're both accurate. So like my account might say, and I sat down at the table with a cup of coffee and I began to write my book. And John can say, Ross sat down at the table. I was there. I saw him. He was writing his book. And I made us a pot of coffee. So there are differences. You see the difference. Both of them have the same story. Both of them are true. So we're going to get into that. Again, last week I gave an assignment that you should do some homework. Now, I'm not taking that homework up, and some of you are relieved. But I do want you to think about these things. But I also said that even if you didn't do it, we're going to do it in class. So I'm a good teacher. I'm nice. I'm not going to. So the two accounts that I want to begin with today, one is in Exodus chapter 32, and the other is in Deuteronomy chapter 9. Exodus chapter 32 is a third-person account of what takes place after we left off last week. So let's go there first. Let's go to Exodus chapter 31, and you're saying, well, I thought you said 32. Go to 31:18, because we follow the white spaces when it's possible. Okay. The white space for this narrative begins right before Exodus 31:18, which we opened with this morning. Because what it's trying to do is it's giving you a story, and the story begins with a set of tablets that were written with the finger of God. So look, we're going to read a few verses, Exodus 31:18. And he gave to Moses, when he had made an end of speaking to him upon Mount Sinai, two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written with the finger of God. Now, notice the narrative is going to give you the other side. What's going on? That's on the top of the mountain. Now look, now we're going to shift and you're going to see what's going on below. And when, chapter 32, verse 1, when the people saw that Moshe delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For this man, Moses, who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we know not what's become of him. And Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me. And all the people broke off the golden earrings that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold at their hand, fashioned it with a graving tool, made it a molten calf, and they said, these are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And Aaron saw it. He built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to Jehovah. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to disport themselves. All right, so what we get here is that Moses has been gone a while, 40 days. We know from the text he's been gone 40 days. And the children of Israel get around Aaron, and imagine the pressure's probably pretty great. He starts up. You, hey, you in charge. Make us gods. This guy Moses, we don't even know where he's been, where he's at. I mean, this is a rugged desert. He's dead for all we know. They don't say that, but they don't know where he's at. Now, what I want you to notice is the immediacy which Aaron places on responding to their request. He doesn't say in the text, guys, I don't think that's a good idea. Let's give him a few more days. Or, I've known Moses for a while. He's coming back, and when he does, it's not going to be good. There's no objection in the text. He just says, give me your earrings. All of y'all, let's give me some gold. And he takes their gold and he's invested in this idol. He makes a calf. Nobody twisted his arm as far as we know. He makes an idol. And then he says, this is your gods. And then aside from making an idol and telling them it's God, and then he says, we're going to do a festival to Jehovah. So now he's mixing idolatry and molten images, and he's calling it Jehovah. That cow didn't bring him out of Egypt, right? But he's saying, this is the God that brought you out of the land of Egypt. It's really, really bad. Like, this is really, really bad. All right, so we're in Exodus 32. You remember, according to the narrative, assuming that this is chronological, they've already heard the words that are going to be written on those stones. If it's chronological, okay? Mm-hmm. So they ought to know better. Now, as we work through the text, I'm not going to read the entire thing, but beginning in verse 7, you're taken back up to the mount, if you will, in the narrative. Jehovah says to Moses, get down quickly. Hurry. Hurry, Moses. Because this people that you brought up from the land of Egypt, they've done some bad things, right? He tells him what's happening. Jehovah says, I see that this people is a stiff-necked people. So he's preparing Moses to go down. Now, I can almost feel, you know how when you, I know you all love the Bible like I do. I try to think about the characters and how they're feeling. I can imagine, based on the narrative and based on how I feel like I know these, I feel that Moses is already growing angry. He's embarrassed. He's ashamed. He can't believe that this is going on. And I wonder if he's thinking, what in the world is Aaron doing? You're telling me something doesn't sound right. I'm having trouble with this. Where's Joshua? Right? How did this happen? So he starts to come down. Now, before he comes, though, or as he's walking, maybe he starts to walk, God tells him, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to wipe this whole group out. You know how, according to the narrative, 603,550 men plus women, animals. I mean, I'm going to wipe it out, and I'm going to start over, and I'm going to make you a goy gadol, a great nation. I'm just going to start over. Now, God has that option. He says, I'm just going to take them all out. Now, in Exodus, when he says this, Moses intercedes. Don't do that. Don't do that. Because then, what are people going to say? You know, in other words, the people around are going to hear about this, and they're going to go, well, the God couldn't bring them into the land that he promised them. He just killed them all in the desert. How's that going to look on you? You understand, I'm paraphrasing. But this is basically the conversation. He's like, don't do that. He intercedes, and Jehovah relents. Jehovah takes this intercession and doesn't wipe out the people, thankfully. So Moses goes down. And then in verse 15 through 35, you read in Exodus what happens from the point. Now, this is where we read last week. He's got the two tablets of the testimony, and we'll get into later. Remember last week, a couple of the texts I indicated that he had the two tablets in his hand in the singular. But there are also references we're going to see today where he has them in both hands. So are they these big things, or can they both be carried in one hand? Or does he have them in, you know, each hand and he's coming down? I don't know. Maybe it's easier to hoof it with when he's got them like that. Either way, says he goes down. Now, at some point, Joshua's with him in the story in Exodus. Now, we don't know that he's, you know, at what point does he meet him at the foot of the mountain? Maybe he's separated himself from what's going on in the camp. But it just says that Joshua is right there, and he says, yeah, here's something in the camp. You almost get the impression that Joshua has not been with the group. You know, he said, I hear some noise, but it's not the kind of noise we want to hear. It sounds like some parties going on. Like, this is not a good thing. So as they come up, Moses, it says, observes the situation, and he becomes enraged. He becomes enraged, and he throws the tablets. He throws the tablets down and smashes it. Now, let's see. Let's pick it up at verse 19. And it came to pass, as soon as he came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing, and Moses' anger burned. And he threw the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf, which they had made, he burns it in fire, ground it to powder, scattered it upon the water, and made the children of Israel drink it. All right. So he takes this calf, and I can imagine, I don't know if anybody's helping him. It doesn't say, it just says he. Moses is flaming mad. He's already smashed the tablets. He takes this calf, grinds it into a fine dust, sprinkles it upon the water, makes them drink it. It almost reminds you of the unfaithful wife in Numbers chapter 5. A lot of commentators have said that. The text doesn't say that, but it's an interesting parallel nonetheless. So after this, Moses directs his attention to Aaron. I imagine, based on the reading, that he's done all of this, and he's like, where is Aaron? Goes to Aaron, and he asks him what happened. Moses said to Aaron, now notice, Moses doesn't want to believe that Aaron is involved, right? So look what he says. Moses said to Aaron, what has this people done to you that you have brought such a great sin upon them? What did they do to you that you would bring this great sin on them? Notice the responsibility of leadership here. I mean, he realizes that they did something, but that ultimately Aaron caused the problem. And then notice, and Aaron said, now watch Aaron's lie. Again, I point this out every time I touch this text. There are religious traditions that say Aaron wasn't responsible. It was those dirty Gentiles that had joined up in Egypt. You know, the mixed multitude. Because it couldn't be a priest doing anything wrong, like they hadn't read the Bible before. It couldn't be anybody that's assigned a position of responsibility in the priesthood. Now watch what Aaron says. And Aaron said, let not the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people, they're bent on mischief. For they said to me, make us gods, which shall go out before us. For as this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we know not what has become of him. Now that part's true. And I said to them, who has any gold? They broke it off, gave it to me. I threw it in the fire, and then out came the calf. Next, we read that Moses sees that the people are out of control, and that Aaron had made them disorderly to the scandal of their enemies. And then the next thing we read in Exodus is that Moses separates the people. He puts the Levites on one side, and there's a great slaughter. 3,000 people die. That is the story, according to Exodus, except that after the slaughter of the 3,000, Moses makes intercession again. I love this horizontal reading because you get details in Exodus. It's becoming more evident to me. Like when I read Exodus, I know how Exodus is going to treat a subject. If there's also a subject in Deuteronomy, I know how Deuteronomy is going to present it. There are things that are obvious. In Exodus, Moses is going to intercede again. And this time Moses says, just blot me out of your book. If you don't forgive this people, just take me out. And God tells him, that's not the way it's going to go down. That's not the way it happens. The person that sins, that person dies. Deuteronomy says this in Deuteronomy 24:16. Deuteronomy always has this consistently. Deuteronomy has no way that a person can go for another person. In fact, people forget that. Later in history, it becomes a very important topic. It's one of the first departures from God's ordained order. In other words, the idea that someone else can pay. And it shows up a lot of places. In fact, in the time of Jeremiah, the people were saying, they had come up with this riddle or this proverb that the fathers eat sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. Meaning that the father does something, the sons get the payment for it. And they're reaping what their parents sowed. Jeremiah calls this a proverb. Who told you this proverb? So there is a proverb going around. Now, go with me. See how I just slid that in, make you think about it? Go to Deuteronomy 9. Deuteronomy 9 and verse 6. Now, remember, Deuteronomy is the first-person account of Moses. Okay, this is like Moses' first person. Beginning in verse 6, now I want to just go ahead and read this. But what he's telling the children of Israel in the first person is the inheritance that you're going to receive that was promised, don't think for one minute that that's because of your righteousness. Right? I like that. Me saying, look, you're commanded in Deuteronomy to be righteous and to do the commandments, and this is going to be your righteousness. Deuteronomy 6, 24 and 25, right? That's a command. But he says, but you're not getting this inheritance because you did that right. Okay, so verse 6, understand, therefore, that Jehovah your God gives you not this good land to possess it for your righteousness, for you are a stiff-necked people. Remember and not forget how you provoked Jehovah your God to anger in the wilderness from the day that you did depart out of the land of Egypt until you came to this place. You have been rebellious against Jehovah. And you go, well, did they have any high good days? Well, it sounds like it's pretty continual. Also at Horeb, you provoked Jehovah to anger so that Jehovah was angry with you to have destroyed you. Notice the first person. When I was gone up into the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant, which Jehovah made with you, I abode in the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I didn't eat bread or drink water, and Jehovah delivered to me two tablets of stone written with the finger of God, and on them was written all according to the words which Jehovah spoke with you in the mountain out of the midst of fire on the day of assembly. It came to pass at the end of 40 days that the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. And Jehovah said to me, get up and get down, or arise and get down quickly from here, for your people, which you brought forth out of the land of Egypt, have become corrupt. They are quickly turning aside out of the way which I commanded them, and they have made them a molten image. And I, and Jehovah said to me, I have seen this people, and behold, it's a stiff-necked people. Let me alone, that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven, and I will make of thee a nation mightier and greater than they. Now, reading horizontally, Exodus at this point, there are already some differences, but one notice that I want to bring to your attention is, in Exodus at this point, Moses said, don't do that. Don't take them out. Deuteronomy doesn't have that. There's no intercession at this point. God says, I'm going to wipe them out, start over, make of you a great nation. And Moses says, and I turned and came down from the mountain. The mountain burned with fire. Two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands. And I looked, and behold, you had sinned against Jehovah your God and made a molten calf. You had turned aside quickly out of the way which Jehovah had commanded you. And I took the two tablets and cast them out of my two hands, broke them before your eyes. Now notice, this is interesting. And I fell down before the Lord as at the first 40 days and 40 nights. Interesting. All right, I just want to go through this. Does he suggest here that when he comes down and he breaks the commandments, does he then fast and intercede for 40 days and 40 nights? Or is that just the way he wrote it? All right, notice, I did not eat bread nor drink water because of all your sins which you had sinned in doing wickedly in the sight of Jehovah to provoke him to anger, for I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure with which Jehovah was angry with you to destroy you. Jehovah hearkened to me at that time also, and Jehovah was very angry with Aaron to have destroyed him. And I prayed for Aaron also at that time. And I took your sin, the calf which you had made, and burned it with fire, stamped it, ground it very small till it was fine as dust. And I cast the dust into the stream that descended out of the mountain. Differences in the intercession. Okay. The basic story is, the same. But there are details in Exodus that Moses' first-person account doesn't cover. There's no mention here of the slaughter of 3,000. Exodus records it, but Deuteronomy doesn't have. And we find in Deuteronomy something very interesting, and just to stress it, he says that Jehovah was so mad at Aaron, he wanted to destroy him. Now, again, if the legend is true that Aaron wasn't really at fault, why would God be so mad at him he wants to blot him out? Right? He's at fault. You, Aaron, made this calf. You led this rebellion. I mean, it's a heavy, heavy thing. And he's the top priest, right? Okay. The second set of tablets. So what we have at this point, we have this incomparable document engraved on stone, both sides, mizeh, this side and that side, from this to this. It's given to Moses, Moses goes down and shatters them. He's just burning with anger. So we need another copy. We need another copy now. So we'll start in Exodus 34, because Exodus 34 is where we get the commission to go with the second commandments. Now, one of the things that I know is that people have different ideas when you get to the second set. I don't know if it's from movies or, you know, what, but people often say, well, you know, God wrote the first set, Moses wrote the second. You know, there are these different ideas, and a lot of people say that. So what we want to do is say, where do those ideas come from, and what does the text say? Because this way you'll get it straight. You might go, well, this is a lot of detail. Do I really need to know all this? Well, you never know when you'll get invited to a Bible trivia game, and or it's about the most significant object in the history of humankind. So, yeah, you need to know this. All right, so Exodus 34. Look at that. Man, just flipped right to it. So verse 1, Exodus 34. And Jehovah said to Moses, third person, hew for yourself two tablets of stone like the first, and I will write upon these tablets, it's Jehovah saying, I will write upon the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. Be ready in the morning and go, come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain, and no man shall come with you. Neither let any man be seen throughout all the mountain, neither let the flocks nor herds before the mountain. And he hewed two tablets of stone like the first, and Moses rose up early in the morning and went up to Mount Sinai as Jehovah had commanded him, and he took in his hand the two tablets of stone. Okay? So Moses hews these two tablets of stone. And he goes up in the morning, making sure no one's with him, making sure you don't even see anybody. And he goes up. And he goes up with these tablets in his hand, knowing that Jehovah said, and I will write on them the same words that were on the first set. And we know what those were. How do we know what those are? Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 12 and 13. It's the covenant. It's the 10 words that he spoke from the mountain, from the midst of fire, on the day of assembly, in your hearing, right? The 10 words. And by the way, in Deuteronomy, it says, and he added no more. That's it. It's like people want to put all kind of things on those tablets and then put all kind of things in the ark, right? But so that's it. Now, when you get to the next verse, in verse 5, there's this interesting passage, and I love it. I'm not going to go into it because it's a separate class, really, but it's where Jehovah reveals himself and his character to Moses. It's one of the most remarkable stories, but it's where, remember in Exodus 33, Moses had said, you know, if I found favor in your sight, show me your glory, and this is the response to that. He gives him, I am Jehovah, Jehovah. You know, he announces his name and then says his character. And then that goes for quite a bit. And then there's this discussion. And then Jehovah reveals a series of laws. He hadn't written on the tablets yet. He reveals a set of laws, verses 10 through 26. And there are all sorts of things. Let's see. Moses made haste, verse 8, bowed down toward the earth. If I found favor in your sight, please go with us, stiff-necked people. And then when Jehovah starts giving these laws, they're not the 10 words, although scholars say this is another account of the 10 words. It's a different 10 words. I'm just putting that out there for you to consider. It's called the other 10. Scholars suggest that this is a different list. But let me move forward. It ends in verse 26. Now, verse 27 is where people get confused. Notice it says, "And Jehovah said to Moses, write thou these words, for after the tenor of these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel." You see, now these words that are mentioned in 34, chapter 10 verse 10 through 26, different set. You see where I'm going? So verse 27 says, "You, Moses, write these words." And then verse 28, "And he was there with Jehovah 40 days, 40 nights. He did neither eat bread nor drink water. And he wrote upon the tablets the words of the covenant, the 10 words. And Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand," and so forth. We'll get into that in a minute. So he comes down. The question is, who wrote the 10 words? Now, I put forward that according to verses 1 through 4, Jehovah says, "You come up here with the stones, and I'm going to write the 10 words, same words that I wrote on the covenant the first time. I'm going to put those on the stones," just like before. Moses comes up, got the tablets. Jehovah reveals a different set of laws. Moses does write those down, but when it comes to putting the words on the tablets, it's got to be, to fit everything else, it has to be the same 10 words. You follow with what I'm talking about? So keep that straight. So what Moses writes is that other set that ultimately make it into a different series of laws, but they're not on the tablets. Now let me cover one more thing in Exodus, then we're going to go to Deuteronomy, which is so much more straightforward. All right. Now in Exodus, Moses comes down from the mountain and he doesn't realize something has happened. His face is radiant. It's so shiny. I don't know if that's the way to describe it, but it's so, let's use radiant. It's so beaming with radiance that the people are scared. Like, they don't even want to go near him. You know, can you imagine, like, as he walks down and his face is shining? And so there's a story about in Exodus 34 where Moses veils his face so as not to scare the people. Which, by the way, there was a question not long ago about how Moses is depicted with horns. That comes from this particular passage because of the Hebrew keren, which is a word that can mean a beam or a ray. And so, you know, they have Moses with little horns. All right? A little bit of trivia for you. Go with me, though, to Deuteronomy chapter 10. In Deuteronomy 10, I can do Deuteronomy's version in 5 verses. At that time, verse 1, Deuteronomy 10, 1, "At that time Jehovah said to me, hew for yourself 2 tablets of stone like the first, and come up to me into the mountain, and make for yourself an ark of wood." All right? I want you to listen. Moses, make an ark. Now learn this. James wrote this article a long time ago. I'm really into this subject now. "Make for yourself an ark, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you did break, and you shall put them in the ark. And I," first person, Moses says, "and I made an ark of shittim wood and hewed 2 tablets like the first, went up the mountain, having the 2 tablets in my hand. He wrote on the tablets everything according to the first, the 10 words, which Jehovah spoke to you," get this, same language, "in the mountain, out of the midst of fire, in the day of assembly, and Jehovah gave them to me. And I turned, went down from the mountain, and I put the tablets in the ark which I had made, and they were there, as Jehovah commanded me." straightforward. God says, Moses, give me two more tablets. You hew them out. You bring them up here. And look, and on your way, make an ark to put them in. You bring the ark with you. You know, or what? Well, he doesn't tell him to bring it with him. So he goes up, makes it. Moses tells us first person, I made the ark just like I was commanded. I bring the tablets. God writes on them. I bring the tablets back. I put the tablets in the ark that I made. And there they are. They're there. So that means all throughout, this, according to the narrative that we're introduced to Deuteronomy, this is right before they go into the land. So it's still in the box that Moses made. Everybody on the same page now? Are you awake this morning? Two passages in the Bible later, 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 9, and 2 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 10, says that the only thing in the box, in the ark, now we're going to get into some ark stuff. The only thing in the ark, the chest, are the two tablets of stone that God wrote on, that he gave to Moses. 1 Kings 8, 9, 2 Chronicles 5, 10. That's it, nothing else. No jar of honey, no nothing else. That's it. No rod that Aaron had that budded. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 4, and rabbinic sources try to put all kind of things in there. According to the Tanakh, just the tablets. The ark with the tablets of the covenant or the testimony come to represent the presence of God. It's there with the children of Israel from the wilderness on up, on up. So when it would set out, let me just give you a couple of points here. Go with me to Bamidbar to Numbers chapter 10. In Numbers, it records this. Whenever the ark would set out, Numbers 10, verse 35. And it came to pass when the ark set forward that Moses said, rise up, Jehovah, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you. So whenever it would set forward, Moses would make this declaration. Rise up, Jehovah. Let your enemies be scattered as the ark is coming, okay? And when it rested, he said, return, Jehovah, to the 10,000 thousands of Israel. So this is sort of a ritual. Every time the ark moves, you know, you can imagine being part of that assembly. I bet people started saying it with him. Rise up, Jehovah. You know, you can hear it echoing through the camp. That's the way I think about it. Like a hymnal, you know, turn to this page. It went with Israel through the wilderness, through the conquest. David would later bring it. I've got a good bit to cover, and I'm going to do it quickly because you'll be able to read this in my book, so don't worry about it. Plus, John will fill in, John Baruch will fill in the gaps. But the idea is that David will later bring it to Jerusalem. You know, 2 Samuel chapter 5 and 6, these stories are conveyed. Remember, the Philistines at one time take it. It's ultimately returned to a man by the name of Amminadab. Amminadab has it in his home for 20 years. And it's superintended or watched over by a man named Eleazar. And so when David decides to bring it to Jerusalem, he decides he's going to do it this way. They get a cart. They put the ark on the cart, and it's this glorious procession. There's music and instruments and dancing and people twirling and spinning around. And then they reach the threshing floor of a man named Nachon, and the ark, you know, it's like an ox kind of stumbles, steps in a pothole or something, and the ark shifts, and Uzzah reaches up to stabilize it, and he's struck dead. This is in 2 Samuel 6. David is sick over this. Says that he's upset. He's upset. He doesn't know what to do. So he says, I'm not bringing this. So he puts it in a man's home by the name of Obed-Edom. And Obed-Edom takes it, keeps it for 3 months, and he's blessed. His stuff starts going really well for him. So David hears word that the home of Obed-Edom is being blessed. So he said, okay, we're going to try this again. Notice this time in the story, he brings it on, it's born, it's carried by men. It's not on a cart. Because if you study according to the Torah, you're not supposed to bring it like on a buggy or a wagon or a cart. You're supposed to bear it on the shoulder. In fact, that phrase is a key. I know a lot of you really like to dig deep. Look at the phrase, those who carry the ark. Look for differences, variations on that phrase. You who carry the Ark of the Covenant and so forth. Because it denotes a certain group, by the way. Very specific. So David decides to bring the ark to Jerusalem. And in this procession, David is dancing with an ephod. It's like he's wearing a linen garment like a priest. And you have to, as you read through 2 Samuel 6, you get to like verse 14, David is, it says in the every six paces, they did a sacrifice. Who did a sacrifice? I mean, is it the priest? Because you would think from Numbers chapter 7 and verse 9 that the priests are the ones that have to carry it on their shoulders. It just doesn't say that in the text. But anyway, so they're moving the ark. And then let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 17. And they brought in the ark of Jehovah and set it in its place in the midst of the tent that David had pitched for it. So David brings it to Jerusalem, sets up the tent, and they put the ark in the tent. Okay? You remember this story? Now look at chapter 7, verse 1 and 2. And it came to pass when the king sat in his house, and Jehovah had given him rest round about from all his enemies, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, see now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells within a curtain. Nathan tells him, go do everything that's on your heart, basically. So David looks out. He says, I'm living in a house, beautiful house, and I got Jehovah living in my backyard in a tent. And that can't be right. I got to build him a house. He thinks it's a good idea. Nathan says, that's a good idea. I mean, I see where you're coming from. But what happens, though, is Nathan goes home that evening. And on his way, Jehovah said, Nathan, need you to go give a message to David. All right, I want you to give him this message. So look down at verse 4. This is the message. And it came to pass that night that the word of the Lord, Jehovah, came to Nathan saying, go tell my servant David, thus saith Jehovah, shall you build me a house for me to dwell in? For I've not dwelt in any house since the time I brought up the children of Israel out of Egypt, even to this day. I've walked in a tent and in a tabernacle. In all the places where I've walked with all the children of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the rulers of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people, saying, why do you not build me a house of cedar? Jehovah has a good question for David. You want to build me a house to live in, and I've never asked for it. I mean, if you can flip here and go to Isaiah 66, Isaiah 66 says it pretty plainly as well. Thus saith Jehovah, verse 1, 66:1, heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you would build for me? Where is the place of my rest? Right? We know these texts. But anyway, so as we work on, what God does next is he ultimately promises David, he says, I'll build you a house, meaning a dynasty of kings that will come from David. And he says, one who comes from your loins will build a house for my name. Right? The question is whether or not God's going to dwell in the house. Now, a lot of people, they say, well, you know, the Shekinah, the Shekinah, the presence of God and so forth, and God dwells in, God said, you're going to build me a house to dwell. Look, let Solomon build a house to my name, dedicated to my name, right? So that's the difference. In fact, in Solomon understood this. 1 Kings 8:27, he says that the heaven of heavens can't contain you. How much this house that I'm building for your name, see? So that's the idea. Now, David tells the story later. You can look it up, 1 Chronicles 28:1-8, where he says, I wanted to build a house. I wanted to build Jehovah a house, but he told me that he's going to build me a dynasty and that my son would build a house for his name. So Solomon makes a shrine in the house. We know it as the Holy of Holies. 1 Kings 6:19. And it says that he builds this place where the ark would rest. Now go with me to 1 Kings 8. 1 Kings 8. And I just want to read the first 9 verses. 1 Kings 8. And Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chiefs of the fathers of the children of Israel, to King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they might bring up the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah out of the city of David, which is in Zion. So he's built the temple. The Ark is in the city of David. He wants to bring it up, right? And all the men of Israel assembled themselves to King Shlomo at the feast in the first month of Etanim, which is the seventh month. At the feast in the month of Etanim. And all the elders of Israel came, the priests took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of God and the tent of meeting. Please notice that the ark is not by itself. They're also bringing the Ohel Moed. You know what that is? We're talking about the tent from the wilderness. A lot of people miss this, all right? And all the holy vessels that were in the tent, even those did the chief priests and the Levites bring up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel that were assembled to him went with him before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be told nor numbered for multitude. And the priests brought in the ark of the covenant of Jehovah to its place in the sanctuary of the house to the most holy under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the ark. The cherubim covered the ark and its poles above. And they drew out the poles, so the ends of the poles were seen from the holy place before the sanctuary, though they were not seen outside, and they are there to this day. And then it says, there was nothing in the ark save the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, when Jehovah made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. Okay, now, the thing that's interesting about this is that a lot of people, the academic world debates on the dating of some of these texts, and they get later and later and later. And I've used this, and every time I see it, I want to remind people. If you're writing, some scholars call the biblical text a pious fraud. If you're going to write a fraud, you don't disprove your own theory. So let me make the point. If I want to say the ark is in the house, you can go see it. It's there to this day. If when that's written, it's not there, you just made yourself into an idiot because somebody could go, I just went to Jerusalem. There's no ark. So this says this was written before the destruction of the temple. You get that? You see my logic? You're not going to give yourself away if you're writing a false document. It's there to this day. All right, now, the thing that I want to draw out of that is that when Solomon, when this comes up, the tent is with it. The temple later is even called the house of the tent. 1 Chronicles 9:23 calls the temple the house of the tent. And then the Talmud even records, according to Sota 9a, it says that the tent from the wilderness was stored beneath the temple. Now, this plays in to something later. Not today, but I want you to know. The ark is there, so is the tent. They're in the house. Now, you remember a few weeks ago in Charlotte, I taught a class on the discovery of the scroll that Moses wrote. All right? And that comes in 2 Kings 22 and 2 Chronicles 34. It describes a discovery. Hilkiah is the high priest. He goes into the temple. There's this project under Josiah's reign. In the 18th year of Josiah's reign, the year is 622 BCE. He's there. They're working to refurbish the house. It's fallen into disrepair. Manasseh is a bad king. Amon, his son, not a good guy, gets killed 2 years in. We're talking 57 years just between those two kings. The temple has gone into disrepair. It requires a reparation work. That's what they're doing. Hilkiah gets excited. A man named Shaphan, a scribe, comes to check on the work. Hilkiah, the high priest, says, I found the scroll of Moses. I found the scroll of Moses, the teaching that Moses wrote. You can imagine, everyone's excited. You really found the scroll. You know what he doesn't mention, and you would think he would? Oh, and the ark is in there too. Now, there are two theories. One theory is, well, the ark was there, but everybody knows the ark's there. It's been there all the time. And you don't even have to mention it. Of course the ark's in there. But it's not in there. I'll show it to you. It's not in there. It's gone. When he goes in and he finds the scroll of Moses, he's excited, and he should be. I'm writing a book about it. You ought to be excited that you found the scroll that Moses wrote. But to not mention the ark, inside the ark is what's written with the finger of God. You got a scroll right here. Look. Moses wrote this. Hey, did you happen to see the ark that had the stones that God wrote on? I didn't see those. Did you look? I mean, it's a box. It's this big. It's about, you know, this. Got poles, cherubim on the top. Didn't see it. No ark. Now, same year, great Passover celebration. In fact, this Passover celebration is so great. It's mentioned twice. It's mentioned in 2 Kings 23, verse 22, and 2 Chronicles 35, verse 18. In one of them, it says that this is the greatest Passover. There hadn't been a Passover like this since the days of the judges. The other text said it's not even, there's not been a Passover like this since the days of Samuel. I mean, that's a long time. You know how many hundreds of years that is? They hadn't even been keeping it right. Meanwhile, the ark is missing. There's no Ark of the Covenant, but it appears. Aha. Go with me. 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles 35. You like a good mystery, folks? 2 Chronicles 35. Moreover, verse 1, 2 Chronicles 35, 1. Moreover, Josiah kept a Passover to Jehovah in Jerusalem. They killed the Passover lamb on the 14th day of the first month. And he set the priest in their watches and encouraged them to the service of the house of Jehovah. And he said to the Levites, who taught all Israel, who were holy to Jehovah, put the holy ark in the house which Solomon, the son of King David of Israel, did build. You need no longer carry it upon your shoulders. Serve now Jehovah your God and his people Israel, and prepare yourselves by the houses of your fathers, and so forth. So I want you to understand, the Passover that's mentioned here, I never say, trust me, I'll say, go read it. It's in the same year, 622 BCE. Big Reformation, scroll is discovered, the ark isn't there, Passover that year, they're keeping the Passover, and then this statement, oh, Levites, could you guys put the ark in the temple? You don't have to carry it on your shoulders anymore. Where was it? Where was it? But hang on, because it's in the temple. We read that. Solomon put it there, put it in the Holy of Holies, pulled the poles out so you could see it from the holy place. It's in place. You assume it's there all along. Clean up of the temple, no ark, Passover, and then you're going to put the ark in. All right, I'll leave that mystery with you because I got a couple other quick points. Josiah dies 23 years later. I'm sorry. Josiah dies, and 23 years after he dies, 23 years after he dies, the Babylonians destroy Jerusalem. When they destroy Jerusalem, there are two records of what they took from the temple. They took the two passages, 2 Kings 25, verse 13 through 17. I'm not reading these because I'm wrapping up. And Jeremiah 52, verse 17 through 23, describe the ransacking of Jerusalem and the temple and what they take out. And guess what's not mentioned? The ark. There's a 36-year window during which the ark can disappear. And we're looking back in history trying to figure out there, but the ark has been missing ever since. Now, this is a quote. I'm all into this right now with my project, but listen to this. This is from Richard Elliot Friedman. He says this about this situation. For some reason, quote unquote, this is Richard, for some reason the biblical sources do not tell what happened to the ark containing the tablets of the Ten Commandments. Archaeology, too, has shed no light on this at all. The disappearance of the ark is the first great mystery of this period, and it remains one of the great mysteries of the Bible. There is no report that the ark was carried away or destroyed or hidden. There is not even any comment such as, and the ark disappeared and we do not know what happened to it, or there's no report that says, and no one knows where it is to this day. The most important object in the world, in the biblical view, simply ceases to be in the story. It's gone. It's gone. It's missing. The two sets, the second set of tablets, the two tablets of stone, the work of God with the writing of God on two sides, mizeu mize, is placed inside the ark. Document that's written, this object that's engraved upon by the finger of God is placed in the box. The box is carried with the children of Israel throughout all their wilderness journeys. It's placed in the temple that Solomon built. Ultimately, it disappears. It reappears. It disappears again. And one prophet, speaking on behalf of Jehovah, said it doesn't matter. Why does he say that? How could he say that? Join us next week. Shabbat Shalom.